Doug and I joined the president and Dr. Biden, and I know everyone here, in mourning for those who were killed, as we pray for those who were injured, and as we grieve for those many people whose lives are forever changed. All of us in this room and in our country understand this violence must stop. And President Biden and I and our administration will continue to provide full support to the local authorities.
Vice President Kamala Harris this morning, flags at the White House are at half staff after a mass shooting at a dance studio in Monterey Park Saturday night. It happened about an hour after the city's annual Lunar New Year festival ended. 11 people were killed, 9 more were injured. The victims were all in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and a few have been identified. LA County Sheriff Robert Luna says the alleged shooter was a 72-year-old man who lived in a trailer park in Hemet. He died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound in his van on Sunday as officers approached his vehicle. No motive has been identified as of yet. But he was reportedly armed with a gun that had a high ammunition magazine that is illegal in California. Saturday's mass shooting is the 36th in the United States since the beginning of the year, according to the Gun Violence Archive, which tracks shootings with 4 or more victims. Joining us to talk about this is Jong Park, Asian American Communities reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to Press Play.
Good afternoon.
You were at the Lunar New Year celebration in Monterey Park, I understand, just hours before the shooting. So I imagine before this happened, it was a night of jubilance, celebration. People were extremely happy to be out and about celebrating.
This was the first Lunar New Year celebration in Monterey Park in 3 years, since 2020. And I was there. There were tens of thousands of people, you know, eating skewers and buying Chinese jewelries and medicine herbs and all of that. It was, as you said, a very jubilant time. It was a milestone that we are getting out of the pandemic, which has hit Asian community especially hard in LA and beyond. And, you know, I think nobody obviously expected that the night would end like this, I think.
Right. What are we learning about the suspected shooter, 72-year-old Hu Can Tran? Do we know anything about a possible motive or what may have led up to this?
You know, my colleagues and I are still trying to figure that out. But we know that 72-year-old Hu Can Tran, and authorities have told some of my colleagues that the shooting might have been sparked by a personal dispute, that the guy, the gunman, may have unspecified emotional problems that were getting worse. And that's something that I've been hearing from some of the people here in Monterey Park, where I'm at right now, from the start, from Saturday night, from Sunday morning, that there was some kind of an emotional issue, that there was some kind of a potentially relationship issues that this guy was having. And that was being discussed over WeChat and different community groups. And it seems like that's what authorities are looking at right now.
I see that perhaps there was a woman in one of these ballrooms, because he did target another one whom he had a dispute with.
Right.
Can you talk about this culture of the ballrooms? The victims were all older, and just tell us what that life is like there in these ballrooms.
Yeah, it's a Western-style ballroom, from what I've been told from some of the folks that I've talked to. But it's a social gathering spot for a lot of Chinese and Taiwanese elders here in the community. Monterey Park is, especially this part of Monterey Park, is where a lot of elders gather. There are boarding houses where a lot of first generation elders sleep for, you know, $15 a night, for instance. And they're looking for things to do and way to socialize with their own fellow immigrants. And dance ballrooms serve as their spots. And this spot in Monterey Park has been one of the most popular ballrooms that's been around for decades. You know, I've talked to the mayor and council member of Monterey Park. They said that they have not been to this ballroom, but they've heard about it from so many folks even before this tragedy happened, because this was such a popular spot for so many immigrants and so many elders in the community.
It's interesting that you say there are many elders who live in these boarding houses for $15 a night. How widespread is that in Monterey Park?
You know, it's something that, you know, we I think the city numbers that I've seen from a few years ago, you know, we haven't looked at this recently, but I think the city numbers put it at hundreds is the number that we've seen. So I think that's probably a fair estimate to go by at the moment.
Right. And so in the larger sense, this community, though, is very mixed in terms of income, right? There are some people, as you say, who live in these boarding houses, but others who are quite affluent.
Right. I mean, I wrote about this about 4-hour story that I did last night, but Monterey Park is a city of contrast. I mean, so many contrasts. There are boarding houses, but there is a LA Times Square, which kind of, reminds me of a lot of Rick Caruso, Americana, you know, the brand, kind of those kind of mall. An apartment there go for, you know, $3,300 for 2-bed. I mean, it's just a full of contrast. And that's what makes, you know, the city so fascinating and so interesting. And, you know, that's something that I tweeted about a few days ago, right after this happened, is that hopefully people recognize all of those differences and intricacies that are happening here in the community, here in Monterey Park.
Right, a community of 60,000 people or so that I guess one developer you quote in your piece wanted to call it the Chinese Beverly Hills in the 70s. His vision was to create a Chinese Beverly Hills.
Right, and this was really where a lot of Chinese and people from Taiwan and Hong Kong settled first to build their immigrant life here in the U.S. It was called Chinese Beverly Hills. Little Taipei was also the name that it was in the 80s, especially because there were a lot of immigrants from Taiwan who were coming to Monterey Park. And things have changed. There are, you know, some immigrants that have moved elsewhere, to Diamond Bar, to San Marino, Alhambra, those more affluent suburbs. But it still remains, in so many way, a hub for so many immigrants here in the community, that they may live elsewhere, but they may come here for their boba or for their noodle soup or for their dim sum. It is a place that they come back to because, even though it might not be their first home, it's their second home because they grew up here. They live their life here. So, there's a lot of significance that I think the community feels about this city and this community.
Right. Delivered Congress's first Chinese American woman in Judy Chu, first Asian female mayor. And also, as you have reported, the city council has two openly gay members. So,
Right.
Is it a relatively young city council?
It's a relatively young city council. There are, people in their 30s and 40s as well. One of the first openly gay elected official in San Gabriel Valley came from, San Gabriel. Henry Lowe, who's the mayor of the city right now, he was elected to the Garvey School District all the way back in 2003. This city, has made history in so many ways, and it shows the diversity, I think, of the Asian American community in so many ways. Thomas Wong, another council member who just got elected last year, he's only 35, and he's the one of the other two openly gay council members in the city. So I think it just makes for a very interesting time and very fascinating city because of the diversity in the city leadership that we're seeing right now.
Right. And so I'm imagining that as we learn more about the victims, people are just, they're devastated that this has happened to shatter their idyllic community.
Right. And that's the reaction I refrain myself from saying it because it's so cliche, but I mean, they never thought it would happen here. I never thought. I mean, I come here once a week or more because my favorite boba shop is right here, half and half, Penman. I mean, there's so many interesting places to get food here and to enjoy the culture. And I never thought, this would happen here. And people who live here, they have told us, my colleagues, they never thought it would happen here. And I think that's the question going forward is how do you recover from this and how do you build it back up? This streets of Garvey Boulevard, where the shooting happened, is downtown Monterey Park. And there has been a lot of discussion for decades at this point, really, about how to revitalize and how to help the mom and pop businesses, a lot of small immigrant businesses that are here. And, I think there's a conversation to be had about, what this tragedy could mean for the vibrancy of the street, of the community going forward.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, and thank you for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
That's Jung Park, Asian American Communities reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, why the end of Roe v. Wade was the beginning of a lot of problems for the anti-abortion movement. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Yesterday marked the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that codified the right to an abortion. Nearly every year since 1973, anti-abortion activists have gathered in Washington around this time of year to protest that decision. And they did it again Friday, insisting the fight to end abortion is not over, even though the court struck down Roe back in June. To signal their new focus, thousands of anti-abortion demonstrators marched toward the Capitol instead of to the Supreme Court.
We are the pro-life generation. We will.
Since Roe's fall, 12 states now have near total bans on abortion. A dozen more could do the same. However, the anti-abortion movement has really struggled to form the same unity and cohesion it once had. And abortion rights activists have scored their own victories, codifying the right to an abortion in three states and Washington, D.C., and defeating anti-abortion amendments in red states like Kansas and Kentucky. We're going to talk about this scene now with Elaine Godfrey, staff writer at The Atlantic. Welcome back to Press Play.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. Well, so you wrote that anti-abortion advocates are basically closer than ever to ending abortion in America, but yet their path forward is, you use the word, more treacherous than it's ever been. How is it treacherous?
So I think that the movement is really happy. They've overturned Roe, which has unlocked all of these possibilities for bans in every state. This has been the ultimate goal for a really long time, or I should say the second most ultimate goal, because the most ultimate goal is banning abortion everywhere. And now they can, you know, conceivably do it. But it's more treacherous because now you have all of this energy diffused throughout the states. There's 50 state legislatures. There's 50 organizations working toward different ends. So it really is, as a woman that I interviewed, an expert on the movement, Mary Ziegler, says, there's a choose your own adventure feel to this right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly right.
And I guess this means that the big national umbrella organizations don't have as much power, because if you're talking about the fight being in all these 50 states and all the fights being somewhat different, then how do they have the same amount, the same kind of power that they had before when there was one single goal?
Right. They don't. They don't have the same influence. They don't have the same sort of ability to shape the narrative, because there are all these different groups and rogue actors pursuing their own ends. So groups like Americans United for Life and the National Right to Life Committee, who have so long worked on legal and political strategies, they've put forward judicial candidates and mapped out political strategy. But now so much of that is at the state level.
And is that because they have different goals?
It is, in part. It is, yeah. At the state level, people tend to be, you know, in more red states, they tend to be a little bit more conservative than the national groups, who are more interested in compromise and more interested in political appeal of the anti-abortion cause. Whereas at the state level, you have some extremists and you have some people who are just a little bit less interested in political compromise. So a Texas pastor and a former state solicitor general were the people who wrote Texas's SB8, which is the ban on abortion after 6 weeks that actually allows private citizens to sue abortion providers. That was not something that national groups had much say in, and they weren't necessarily supportive of it. Some people that I talked to said they were pretty alarmed by that.
Well, so speaking of national groups, Americans United for Life proposed what's called the Ready for Life Act, which is, I guess, a sort of blanket legal language for state lawmakers to use in bills to ban abortion. This was revealed, I guess, or unveiled in November, so well after Roe was overturned in June. Why did they wait so long?
Yeah, it's a great question. They've had decades to propose this kind of model legislation, and they have. They've done so, but it's just that in the aftermath of Dobbs, which overturned Roe this summer, there was no uniform law put forward by the movement. There was no sort of universal, you know, uniform guidance issued. So you had this patchwork of trigger laws and old, you know, 19th century laws on the books that came into effect instead of this effort to get everybody on the same page. And I asked the senior counsel for the Americans United for Life about this. And he said, well, we needed time. We needed those 5 months to analyze the impact that Dobbs would have. And I think that that's true, I suppose, to a certain extent, but they had years to anticipate Roe being overturned. They had decades. So it's not really a great excuse.
Hmm. Is there even a way to discern what the ultimate goal is? Do most anti-abortion activists want a complete ban, or do they want some exceptions? Do they want limits on time, like allowing abortions in certain in the early weeks, but not after a certain time period? Do they favor heartbeat bans? Like, is there some uniform desire when it comes to what they want to see?
Yes. So if you ask virtually anyone in the anti-abortion movement, they will tell you they would like to see abortion made illegal with maybe only a very few number of exceptions, probably just life of the mother exceptions, in all 50 states. That is the ultimate goal. It's just that some organizations are pushing for a 15-week ban or a 6-week ban as a way to get there, right? They're sort of incrementalists versus absolutists. And then, you know, you have, I think what is alarming some people in the movement is there is a rising voice in the movement to pursue punishment for women who seek and obtain abortions. They are a fast growing minority in the movement that I think is scaring some of the leaders right now.
Hmm. And meanwhile, Lindsey Graham unveiled a national bill, and that pretty much went nowhere. How come?
So I think there's a few reasons for this. I think, number one, it was right before an election, and it wasn't really a priority to support new legislation, especially legislation that wasn't going to pass. But I think the main reason is that it is not popular. I mean, abortion with restrictions is generally supported by most Americans. But I think after what we saw in Kansas with people rejecting restrictions on abortion, rejecting a ban on abortion in Kansas, that really shocked a lot of people in the pro-life movement. And it shocked a lot of Republicans who have hitched their wagon to the movement, or maybe vice versa. But I think it shocked a lot of people. And they thought, okay, maybe this is not something that I want to touch politically. And at the time that Lindsey Graham proposed this legislation, Mitch McConnell even said, listen, most of my members would like to deal with this at the state level. And I think that was sort of him giving everybody an out, because politically it's become a little bit toxic. And I think we can expect more like that to come.
Elaine Godfrey, staff writer at The Atlantic, where she has been writing about the anti-abortion movement. Elaine, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in the days leading up to Sunday's 50th anniversary of Roe, the Supreme Court released its final report into who leaked the draft of last summer's Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. And we learned not much. After interviewing nearly 100 court employees, looking at computers, printer records, call and text logs, investigators could really not say who had leaked the decision or how it had ended up in the hands of the Politico reporters who published it. We're going to talk about what we know and what we don't and what the findings of this breach mean for the future of the court with Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So these reports are usually full of legalese, legal jargon. This one is no exception. But there's one line I want you to talk about in this report. It says, investigators have been unable to determine at this time, using a preponderance of the evidence standard, the identity of the persons who disclosed the draft majority opinion. What do you make of that?
I think it means that they don't know, or they stopped when they thought, oh my gosh, maybe we might find out. But I think option number one is the most likely. Preponderance of the evidence is basically the lowest standard in the law. It just means more likely than not. And so they're making it clear that it's not that they really think they have somebody, they just can't show proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard in a criminal case. What they're saying here is, we really don't know. Based on, as you said, they interviewed 97 people, some people more than once. Many people signed affidavits. They had to swear under oath to the truth of their answers. They are saying, we really don't know.
And did they actually interview the justices? And I know there was some fair amount of pushback after this report came out on Thursday that the justices were not subject to affidavits.
That's right. So they did interview the justices, but I think the word interview here is probably doing a lot of work in the sense that the law clerks and the court staff, I think, had very different interviews. As we mentioned, some of the law clerks, I think, had to sign affidavits under oath under penalty of perjury, saying that all of the information that they gave to the investigators was true. I believe that's why a number of the clerks admitted that they speak to their spouses about some of these decisions, that they do, in fact, talk to their significant others about things that they shouldn't. And I think that the interview with the justices, frankly, had a much lighter touch. And the reporting indicates that they were not asked to sign anything.
So this was supposed to restore some confidence in the court after this huge security breach. Did it do that?
I don't think it did, in part based on what we were just talking about. You know, on the Supreme Court, on the building itself, it says equal justice under law. And when you treat the justices different from everybody else, that doesn't feel particularly equal. And there are a number of things where there are a number of steps along the way where I think we can look at how this investigation was conducted, who Chief Justice Roberts even decided to be in charge of the investigation, a marshal, not, for instance, the Department of Justice, and say, we're not sure that this was really ever designed ultimately to find the leaker. Now, look, I don't want to say this was a sham investigation. I do not think it was under any circumstances. The former head of the Department of Homeland Security looked and said this was a thorough investigation, but not one, I think, that really restored our confidence in the institution.
So that's it? There'll be no more investigations? We'll just never really know?
I think we'll know when the book comes out in 10 or 20 or 30 years, when somebody says, I think it's going to be like a deep throat moment for Watergate, where we didn't know for years. And then there's a book, there's a famous book about the Supreme Court called The Brethren, where a number of the law clerks spoke to the authors. And then we really got a behind the scenes look. I think we'll find out at some point, but the investigation at this point is done. And I think the court is really hoping it's done because they want to move on to, you know, changing the direction of the law in our country.
Okay, let's change direction in terms of our conversation and come closer to home and talk about former LA City Councilman Jose Huizar. He pleaded guilty to charges of tax evasion and racketeering. He admitted he took at least $1.5 million in bribes from real estate developers, and the sentencing hasn't been scheduled yet. But in his plea deal, prosecutors said they would not request a sentence longer than 13 years, but Huizar can't ask for a sentence less than 9 years. So is that fairly normal? Seems like a long sentence for a white collar crime.
It does seem like a long sentence, but I think all of the evidence indicates, and Huizar has at this point admitted, that he really did run a criminal enterprise and to the detriment of the public. He was in a position of public trust. He abused that. And this wasn't a one-off. What we know from other people who pled guilty, people who worked for him, and the people who apparently bribed him, is that this was a fairly lengthy criminal scheme. And the federal government does typically take abuse of the public trust seriously. So yes, this is real prison time, and I think it deserves real prison time.
So he was basically accused of taking all sorts of money and other bribes, such as casino gambling chips, flights on private jets, luxury hotel stays. He and others, concert tickets. Another councilman has already served time. How big was this scandal, this pay-to-play scandal in Los Angeles?
I think it's quite big, and it shows that, frankly, we have a number of cracks in the system. I don't think that that will be news to people who listen to your program and are very educated about Los Angeles politics. Part of Huizar's story is a story of how we approve land use deals in our city and how much power individual city council members have, depending on which district they sit in and depending on which committees they sit in, over these incredibly big proposed developments. And again, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, sometimes even more. And developers really want these projects to go through. And there are people like Jose Huizar who abuse the system. Now, there's no perfect system, but I think what we've seen in a number of instances, and this being maybe the most infamous, is that we do have those who ask for our trust and then abuse our trust.
Jessica Levinson is a professor at Loyola Law School and Press Play's Legal Eagle. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a record number of films at this year's Sundance Film Festival.
65% of the films chosen this year are from women filmmakers. There are a record number of works from indigenous filmmakers, films by Asian filmmakers, Black filmmakers.
We'll have a report from Park City next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Filmmakers, celebrities, and movie fans from around the world are in Park City, Utah this week for the Sundance Film Festival. The first time since the start of the pandemic, the event is in person. Ted Robbins is a reporter and editor and a former supervising editor for arts and culture at NPR, and he's in Park City with all the masses, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
So is it crazy? Is that Main Street just a parking lot?
Yes. In fact, I was trying to get to a movie the other night. I didn't make it because I had to wait a half an hour for an Uber, and then the 5-minute ride was another half an hour ride.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. So what is the mood like there? Are people jubilant?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously it's exciting if you like movies, if you love movies. There are more than a dozen theaters here. And as I said, you know, sometimes tough to get from one to the other. Tons of meetings going on behind closed doors. And that, I'll put all that on top of people who are here skiing. And it's crowded.
Right. Yeah.
It's even tough to get a ticket to movies.
What about the COVID situation? Are people worried about that?
You know, I thought they would be. They're not. And there are not really any protocols. There are signs that say mask wearing is encouraged, but not many people are wearing masks. The volunteers and the festival staff, they're all wearing masks. And we'll just see if it becomes a super spreader event. But I have not heard anything yet, which is good news.
Okay, well, let's hope you stay healthy. So for that reason, the festival was virtual for the last 2 years. And now it's a bit of both.
Yeah, it's a hybrid format. The films are screening in person, and then a few days later, they're being shown online for the period of time until the festival ends. And then a little secret that even before the pandemic, a lot of critics have been screening movies online or on DVD. It's just more convenient if your job is watching movies to not have to schlep around.
Yeah, it sounds like it, especially with all those people there. And you can't even get to the movies you want to see, as you mentioned.
Yeah, yeah. Although if you do have a press credential, you get to go to the head of the line. I spoke with director Paula Eisel. She had a documentary called Aftershock at Sundance Online last year. It was about the healthcare system and how it fails women in childbirth, frankly. And this year, she's here with a short called Under God. And she has mixed feelings about this hybrid format.
I think being in person is amazing and important and really could propel a film to go really far, but I don't want to discount how fortunate virtual access can be for many people.
So Under God is looking for a distributor, and it is not showing online. The movie's fascinating. It's a short, and she put it together pretty quickly over the last 9 months or so. It's about a legal challenge to anti-abortion laws under the theory that many religions, aside from fundamentalist Christians, accept abortion as a right, including Judaism and Islam. And so they're using this, they're kind of flipping, you know, the script here. And she hopes that the movie, along with being entertaining and enlightening, also acts as sort of, as she called it, a blueprint for legal challenges in other states.
Oh, interesting, especially on this anniversary, 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. All right, there were more than 16,000 submissions this year, I understand, the most Sundance has ever received. Why so many?
Well, Sundance is for independent films, features, docs, shorts, and there are a lot more independent filmmakers than there are studio filmmakers. And Sundance really is also unabashedly progressive and inclusive. 65% of the films chosen this year are from women filmmakers. There are a record number of works from indigenous filmmakers, films by Asian filmmakers, black filmmakers. I talked with director Raven Jackson. She is here with her first feature film. It's called All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt, which is a great title, I think. And not only is this the first time she's seen her movie with an audience, she was able to bring most of her cast and crew here. And that was the first time we've been together since shooting the movie almost 2 years ago.
It's been really special to bring this project to Sundance, especially the first year back after the pandemic began. You know, so many filmmakers I admire have been through the festival, and so it feels nice to be a part of the community now.
And Ted, of course, this is also a place to conduct business, and a lot of these filmmakers want to sell their movies. So is there a frenetic deal-making scene happening?
Boy, are buyers and sellers busy. Some reps are seeing six films a day. Sellers are taking 10 meetings a day. The folks I've spoken with say that so far it's a lot like the 2019 festival, which had pretty healthy sales. And that said, larger streamers like HBO and Netflix are here, but some of the smaller streamers did not send either anybody or full teams.
So far, what are the films standing out to you, and what are the films getting the most buzz?
The earliest one was a documentary about called Justice, about Brett Kavanaugh, and it was it brought in new allegations of sexual abuse during his college days. That got a lot of buzz because it was a last minute entry, and it showed, you know, the first night. He's not going to leave the Supreme Court because of a movie.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see. Another one, early one, doc about the rock and roll pioneer Little Richard. It got a wonderful reception. I mean, you know, great music and an interesting life. That one sold over the weekend. Another doc about Michael J. Fox and his struggles with Parkinson's was picked up by Apple. Cat Person, based on a New Yorker short story, which went viral. I'm looking forward to seeing that too, and seeing a lot of these, if I can't see them here, seeing them the old fashioned way.
Virtually. Ted, stay safe, have fun, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ted Robbins is a reporter and editor and former supervising editor for arts and culture at NPR, and he is at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City. The festival runs through January 29th. Coming up, my conversation with Velvet Underground co-founder John Cale. He has had a huge influence on modern music, and he's still looking to push boundaries. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For 60 years, the musician John Cale has experimented with sound. He has built a massive discography of avant-garde rock with dozens of solo albums, film scores, and collaborations with artists like Patti Smith, Brian Eno. His rise began in downtown New York in the 1960s with the Velvet Underground.
Lady Godiva, dressed so demurely. That's the head of another curly-haired boy. Just another toy.
That's their 1968 song, Lady Godiva's Operation, one of the few from the group where Cale sings. He founded the band with Lou Reed, and they quickly became the epitome of cool, their subversive songs, hanging out with their producer, Andy Warhol. Cale is now 80 years old and has just released his 17th solo album. It's called Mercy, his first new music in a decade.
Rolling around in the snow and the mud, lights exploding above.
John Cale joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, Madeline. Good to hear you.
It's nice to hear your voice, still with a bit of the Welsh accent. I can do that. Why did you call this album Mercy?
Oh, it was trying to escape all the shibboleths about songs that mean too many things at once. Mm. It had taken a long time to do. It was like 2.5 years in the making, and I was just coming back from tour, Sao Paulo, and landed in L.A., and it was lockdown. And so I had time to sit and listen to what was there. I'd written all the material before, so I went at it, and some of the songs were really badly needing some construction, deconstruction and reconstruction. So I started again.
How do you know when a song needs to be redone, reconstructed? What is it?
When you're bored with it. Not everything falls into place at once. Mm-hmm. I didn't change any of the songs, but the people that I managed to grab a hold of and put in the track, they added something for sure. I mean, I knew many of the musicians. I'd worked with them before, and they each added their own unique abilities.
One of them is Wiseblood, who is 34 years old. And how did you meet her and convince her to work with you on this album?
Well, she came and performed at some of these concerts that I'd given on the Velvet Underground 50th reunion concerts. And it was really how her voice affected the track that did it for me. I mean, she has a very passionate, warm voice. And Story of Blood was an awkward concept to put into an album. So I wanted her to sing the chorus, Swing Your Soul.
A somewhat difficult, awkward concept. What did you mean by that?
Well, he can't make it too happy, and you want to contain all the emotion in the track. Wes did the vocals, and they were really perfect, and I was really happy that we got to work on it. And some of the other songs were really characterized by the singing that was there. Mm-hmm. Animal Collective, for instance, did Everlasting Days, and I enjoy the company and I enjoy them as musicians, so they've become kind of an extended family for me these days. I knew we'd have fun messing around on the track together.
You have spent so much of your life working in collaboration with other artists, and I guess I'm wondering what that does for you versus working solo on your own stuff. I guess maybe you had to work solo during the pandemic, but do you prefer collaborating and working with other musicians?
Yeah, I always do. It's always where you learn more, and you really want to have as many concepts in the song by other people as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy when I collaborate. I mean, improvisation has always been something that I've done more of than anything else. That's where you learn from other people.
Yeah. Even if, as is famously told and retold, your collaboration with someone like Lou Reed could be very contentious, fractious.
He collaborated with anybody.
He in particular. But you did collaborate so successfully. What did you learn from Lou?
Well, he enjoys improvisation as much as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
When I first met him, that was the one thing that stood out. He was making up lyrics about what we were doing that day. For instance, if we went into the studio at noon, the first lyrics, if we were starting at 10 o'clock in the morning, he would start singing about what we were doing at 8 o'clock that morning. And it would all be a tale to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very good way of working. And I know from experience that doing a new and different track is always something of a challenge, and some excitement has its own excitement.
So he was an incredible storyteller and an incredible wordsmith. And
yeah.
And you just listen to a song and all of a sudden you're in the world. And so I guess I'm wondering, it's one thing to craft a world with words. How do you do it with music?
Well, you can't ignore the atmosphere that you create anytime you pick up an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you bring your own spirit to the front, and everybody else that works with you, they are immediately drawn into the surroundings. On Marilyn Monroe's Legs, I had actress, a synthesist, and I'd already started to build a song on an improvisation piece centered around scattered lyrics and an orchestral bass, a cello drone. And when we sat down and worked on it in London, we sat in the studio and he patched and pushed his machines around, and it became like a warm blanket. And I'd asked him to take a few of my vocal lines, distort them, and feed them back into the song, and it worked perfectly.
And what is the song Marilyn Monroe's Legs about?
Well, it was a song. It's about I wanted to write a song about Marilyn Monroe's legs and not mention her at all in the song. So I wanted to, avoiding traps.
Shibboleths.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about another song about someone you collaborated with a lot before she died, Nico. And she died in 1988. And let's play a song that you have on this album called Moonstruck, Nico's song. And here's a bit from that.
You're a moonstruck junkie lady, staring at your death.
tell us about this song and your relationship with Nico.
Well, I've gone through several manifestations of Nico, and they were all exciting in the most unexpected way. She became a songwriter because she heard Jim Morrison talk about one way of getting to the core of the song is to write the words down first and then find an instrument and add to it. And it took a while to get to the point where she had a harmonium, but she had a real atmosphere about her in any case. And that atmosphere lasted for many, many years.
Yeah, she has said that her life really began after the Velvet Underground and her musical career. Do you feel the same way?
Well done. Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, people are starting to realize that in a way, her songs are improving. A lot of people are really getting to like listening to her songs and not seeing such a maniacal approach to songwriting.
So she wasn't, you don't think she's as appreciated back then as she is today?
Well, I think she is being appreciated now.
Yeah,
and
more.
More. And it's good to hear.
Yeah. So how is she with you as you create songs?
And she has a spirit that she carries mm-hmm. with her. And I don't know why our friendship lasted so long, but it was her spirit that I appreciated.
Right. And so you have worked with, I mean, I guess modern music has your name all over it. You're just a through line through most of modern music. You started out, though, at the beginning of your career, interested in classical music. Do you return to that from time to time?
Well, it's there. I mean, it's been there all my life, and I was brought up as the son of a music teacher, so I mm-hmm. took advantage of it as much as I could. I mean, it's a good way of moving on to several different things and getting to know the avant-garde and understanding what the European avant-garde was. It helped me get past the high school stages until I finally came to New York and joined Lamont Young's Theater of Eternal Music.
Yeah,
that was the avant-garde, pure and simple. And I was floored by it.
Is it true you once gave an 18-hour concert?
Yeah, it was, well, John Cage asked me to come and play a version of Satie's Vexations. There was something going on in New York that was unusual at the time. People were very busy creating different things and putting music and art and painting and together. I mean, this is also when Andy was running film experiments. The factory was set up, and a lot of people really were there because of generosity from Andy, but is also there because everybody was working. It was a very exciting and busy time, and it was a revolution.
So what now can you point to that is similar in any way in terms of avant-garde art, be it music, writing, painting, anything?
Well, I think when the time hip hop came around, that was the avant-garde of the day. What's going on in hip hop is really breaking surfaces all, you know, everywhere.
Would you ever want to work with a hip hop artist?
Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely.
who would you like to work with?
Young Fathers is a band in Glasgow. They're really trying hard to push the boundaries of their style of music, which is very lively. But there are a lot of others, and it'll happen.
On your next album, maybe.
Yes.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Madeline. Very nice of you.
That's John Cale. His new album is called Mercy, and it's out now. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can follow us on the socials, Twitter and Instagram. We are at KCRW Press Play. I'm at The Mad Brand. And you can also download our podcast at KCRW.com/Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.